Refugees and border walls, woke celebs and socialist chic, social engineering and COVID lockdowns. It's easy to get wound up over what's happening in our country and in the world. That's why it's time for Act and Unwind, a weekly roundtable discussion tackling current events from the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty. Every Monday, join host Eric Cohen and Acton Institute experts, including Dr. Samuel Gregg, Reverend Robert Sirico, Dr. Stephen Barrows, and more in this weekly audio public square where news, politics, religion, and culture meet for an ongoing conversation on a free and virtuous society. Act and Unwind will explain the news of the week through the Acton Institute's unique perspective, connecting good intentions with sound economics as it works to promote and to shape a society that is secure, free, and virtuous, one characterized by individual liberty and sustained by religious principles. To subscribe to Act and Unwind, visit acton.org/NR or search Act and Unwind on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever fine podcasts are available. That's acton.org/NR. To subscribe, please check it out.
Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the October 27th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim. I'm president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's an author, a political commentator, and the founder of the eponymous investment firm, The Bonson Group, and a gift giver. Hello, David.
Hello, Will. I am a gift giver. And we're going to talk about that not just for you, but even for our listeners. I have an idea.
And this is for real. This is not scripted. David handed me the book just before the show and said I could read the inscription, which is not written on a book plate. Here it is. And you're really okay with this. We're not going to...
I'm also okay with you pointing out that it's not written on a book plate. If someone said, Dave, go write it on a book plate, I would have been like, okay.
To my dear friend and co-laborer in the cause of a free and virtuous society. That is really sweet. And it's true.
You are my co-laborer in that cause. That is our cause.
Yeah.
We're doing our best. It's not going very well.
Oh, come on. It's
no,
going
it is
great.
Going. It is. We're making
progress. I think you and I are both, I'm going to speak for myself, but I think you're in this boat. I consider myself a Christian existentialist and an existentialist in the sense that I can't make sense of the whole universe, so I just try to do the next indicated thing and trust the process. Trust God.
So I know what you mean, but I most certainly do not consider myself a Christian existentialist. But if one defines it the way you just did, which is most certainly not what real existentialism is, then I am.
It is, though. And it's just,
mean is that there are things we can't control and we are content to let the secret things belong to the Lord, as the great book of Deuteronomy says, then I'm fully on board.
Yes.
And to the extent that there is a philosophical connotation that I think is much more severe than that in existentialism, that I think is incompatible with the truth claims of Christianity.
My hero is a guy like Camus or Kierkegaard, not Sartre. And it's my sense that, you know, we have the freedom to choose a story which either serves us or doesn't, and I choose a peculiarly Christian story, specifically Christian story. That's just mine. And yes, the secret things belong to the Lord. Okay, so we have so much to get to, but thank you for There's No Free Lunch. I am so grateful for this book. It's now available.
There's No Free Lunch, 250 Economic Truths.
Yes. And I got this book for free, so I am so grateful for the gift, my friend.
Guess how many days the book has been number one on the free enterprise and capitalism category?
How many days?
On the Kindle, it's been 8 days, and on the audio, it's been 10 days.
And it's only been out about 8 or 10 days.
Yeah, it still hasn't a release on the Kindle. The audio is download now, live, real. But on the Kindle, anyone buying now is going to get the download on November 2nd. Mm-hmm. Then the hardcover, the street date, meaning the day it'll arrive at your doorstep, is November 9th. So we're in crunch time, and things are going well. But should we share our plan for our listeners?
It's your plan. I'd love to hear it. Then I'll declare mine.
So my wife, who works at my company as our director of style and experience, she handles our branding, our special events.
She's really good, I gotta say.
Yeah, she's got this sort of aesthetic, talent that, let's just say, I don't have. Okay.
So this is truly, like, I'm not blowing smoke here. If this were just you and me, I'd say she's done an awesome job in your office. I love coming into the studio here. This is all her, huh?
Well, the studio, our producer, Brian Tong, built this out because this is obviously not so much for aesthetic but function, right? Like, this is a lot of technical side.
Sure.
But, like, as far as the pretty around the
color,
office,
the color, the
furniture, and then not just here, but she did a remarkable job in our New York City office now. We moved into a new office in New York this summer, and she just got done installing our whole office in Minneapolis. And we'll soon be doing the same in Nashville, Tennessee. We are opening an office in Q1 in Nashville.
Wow.
So anyways, she came up with the idea with the book of a coloring book with me putting an economic term or a financial term and a very brief definition and then a whole lot of graphic and coloring things and some special branded crayons and all the stuff around it. And I thought, oh, okay, that's kind of fun, whatever, it sounds nice. I didn't think people would really care, and then people have been loving it.
Now wait a minute, coloring book for kids? This is not,
well, because, by the way, oh, that's great, you brought up another topic. That's because that's the only kind of coloring book there is.
Brother, I'm just telling you, you must know that people your age and younger, not my generation,
they are only my age on their driver's license. I heard about this thing a few years ago.
Yes.
At least 5 years ago. I found out there were adults that were doing a coloring book
coloring books.
Part of their safe space.
Yeah, it's
part of their self-care.
Yeah.
Part of their mental health day.
I think.
And I immediately thought, I need to find out if any of my employees are doing this.
In fairness, I think that a lot of us doodle, and maybe that's all that is, except that it's purposeful, intentional doodling, and I don't do that. But anyway, I don't judge. But okay, so you've got a coloring book. What's the offer for the listener?
If somebody buys one of the books, we're starting off with them buying it.
All right.
But then they send us,
okay,
just like we used to have them do the review of the in the podcast. Mm-hmm. If they send us that they post a review to Amazon, we will send them a free coloring book and crayons if they happen to have kids or grandkids that can use it. Now, if they want to use it for themselves, they can, but I don't want to know about
it. It's a don't ask, don't tell.
Right, exactly. Don't ask, don't tell. Only the consequences here are much worse than the other one, if you know what I mean. Okay. But
Listen, Brian, you're going to have to erase the show. That's,
but then
that will not,
we will also send another copy of the book.
Fantastic.
So if they write a
review of the book
that they bought, we will get another one to them that they can give away to someone a copy of the coloring book.
Can we try to get this out like ASAP so that they can have it for Christmas and pretend that they...
Yeah, because this offer is on from the time the book comes out, November 9th, through Thanksgiving.
That's it.
Well, you know, we'll do something else in December, but I don't want to keep it in perpetuity because at some point I got to think about the staff's management of stuff.
That's sweet.
That's the idea.
Okay.
I think that's generous.
That's a very generous offer.
I do like the idea of just saying you don't have to do anything. We're just sending you a copy of the book. But the name of the book is literally there's no free lunch.
Yeah.
So in this case, there's no free book, but there is a free book that comes with the book you pay for, which is the same thing as saying there's no free book.
I love it. Okay. So I want to start with what I did over my weekend. And I should point out, you're here. I had no idea until I think very early this week that you're going to be back in the studio.
I don't ever want people to know where I am.
I guess. So
here today, gone tomorrow.
You almost literally are, though, right? I mean, next week I
fly out tomorrow night.
Okay.
But then I'll be back Thanksgiving week. I'll actually come back the weekend before Thanksgiving, and then I'll be out here for a couple of weeks, and so we'll have a good little run.
Lovely. Okay. And
I'm going to see you in Grand Rapids.
Yes, actually.
So let's record out there.
How fun would that be?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll do it.
I mean, not in the same room. You'll be in your room. I'll be in mine. We'll Zoom, but we'll both be in Grand Rapids.
And Brian will be somewhere else?
Yeah.
Okay. Sounds fair. I'll also be visiting friends in New Orleans. When I say friends, I mean work colleagues around the country. I'll be right before that, I think, if I remember correctly. I'm so confused about my schedule right now. Anyway, over this past weekend, on Saturday, I participated in a Cato Institute panel discussion. Mayor Eric Garcetti was there. And we talked about the problems of poverty and inequality in California and Cato's latest study of the problems, the obstacles in place. And as you might expect from Cato, a wonderful libertarian free enterprise kind of group, a lot of the findings are consistent with what we've talked about on this show. I'll put this in the show notes so people can go and read the document themselves. It's a pretty exhaustive survey of things like you know, zoning exclusion laws and crime reduction policies and homeless, et cetera. And I think it's fair to say Michael Tanner is the author of the project. He oversaw the whole thing, and it's a pretty remarkable and comprehensive piece. My contribution was to say, basically, to Michael, you know, from your lips to God's ears, almost all of these things require that reformers and activists would run through the gauntlet of government unions or private sector unions to get these things done. So that, you know, one of the things is, well, we have to restructure CEQA, the California Environmental Equality Act, that is always used either by the private sector trade unions or by environmentalists or no-growth homeowners in particularly liberal towns to block any kind of new development. It's just all you have to do is shoot up a flare and say, we object on environmental grounds, and any kind of construction project in California, including reservoirs and dams and roads and schools and homes, you name it, are blocked. It's used by corporations to block.
But how long does it last for? How it's effective at slowing things down, but is it how effective is it at permanent slowdown?
Virtually perfectly effective if you're on the wrong side, because all you have to do, the fact that the study can take time, so you raise an objection that, hey, this violates environmental laws on these grounds, or we think you didn't do a sufficient study, government, in taking a look at the impact on agricultural lands or migratory birds. So it takes 3 years to get the new study out or whatever, and then a CEQA complaint is filed again, and the whole process begins with new complaints being filed, et cetera. And this can go on in perpetuity. Corporations, you and I discussed one event in Central California where one grocery store hired a CEQA front group to block the construction of another grocery store competitor. So this happens up and down the state.
But is there a process for invalidating the inappropriate use of it at a certain level, like in something like that where it's somewhat sinister? I mean, it's always sinister, but where it's like egregious.
No, I think that to my knowledge, the only possibility of a backstop on this, of a limiting principle, if you will, is a good judge. Like, seriously, that's what it takes in California.
Well, which, of course, is what the bench exists for.
Yes, it ought to exist for that. Yeah. And in California, it does not. It has become an auxiliary of the government unions and the Democrats primarily. We could talk about that all day. They talked about, you know, removing barriers to the growth of charter schools. I support it. Establishing a tuition tax credit. Support it. Restructuring pension obligations. Completely heatedly agree. And yet every one of these things is blocked by the power of the government unions. You and I talk about episodes after episode after episode.
Yep.
So I didn't want to, you know, go through the whole thing, except to say that what sort of surprised me, I have to say, is that my two counterparts, if you will, on the panel were a gentleman from the United Way. He was terrific, talked about the real costs of living in California, which are unbelievable, and taxes are, of course, a huge function of that. And then a really kind man from the Urban League, probably roughly my age, 60s or so, an attorney, an African-American man, who literally called business slavery. He said that businesses are modern slavery, and then went on to cite the 1619 Project, which he had only recently discovered. And so I took a few minutes to just say, like, wow, you know, there is nothing more hostile to the notion of slavery than real free market capitalism. And I think it's dangerous and, you know, borders on, you know, real malfeasance here to let this pass without comment. So we talked a little, you know, I talked a little bit about the fact that it was, in fact, free market conservatives from the North who, you know, were the driving force in the union's war and the destruction of the apartheid system in the South. Anyway, it was an odd conversation in that regard, that there wasn't really serious consideration on the part of some of the panelists, I think, about the barriers to reform in California being these, you know, seemingly sometimes insurmountable government unions. So anyway, I'll put that in the show notes. People can go read the study for themselves. It's, you know, it's enlightening. And I think listeners to this show will understand what I'm saying about the problems with reform. I would be remiss, David, if I didn't bring up Alec Baldwin, the actor, who's I could just stop right there. Nobody could fill in the blanks. Am I right? This is he pulls out a pistol on the it turns out to be loaded, and he
very sad.
It's horrible. And I had a couple of, you know, conservative friends, I'm going to say, who said, well, you know, he's got more blood on his hands now than any Second Amendment person. I thought, whoa, dude, too soon. And on the other side,
and too soon and too stupid.
Yeah, I mean, this was clearly a horrific accident.
But have you seen the worst response to the Alec Baldwin thing? Are you aware of what I'm about to say?
I'm not sure. Tell me.
The gentleman running for the Senate in the great state of Ohio, national figure backed by Pete Thiel, wrote one of the great books I've read in the last 10 years, Hillbilly Elegy.
Mm.
J.D. Vance tweeted, "Dear Jack, please let Trump back on Twitter so we can see his Alec Baldwin tweets."
Oh, gosh.
If he had been in the room when I read that tweet, I probably would have punched him. Because this is so beneath us. First of all, J.D. Vance is a fellow professing Christian. This is tasteless. It's classless. It's stooping to their level. The two wrongs make a right argument. People that are right now listening to us thinking, don't they know how bad the other side is? Mm-hmm. I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
We're better than this.
Yes. And this is...
And you're talking about a person who was not Alec Baldwin, who, as far as we know, might not have even been a liberal,
yeah.
who's dead,
right?
Who has a family.
Yeah.
So shut the hell up.
Yeah. This was it was deeply disturbing to me to see some of that. And I can't say that, you know, any of these comments you and I are citing, whether it's J.D. Vance or my two friends who, you know, I know and love, and I think were probably just speaking privately, you know, things they would not necessarily say publicly.
Yeah. J.D. tweeted this to 5 million people.
Yeah. My friends did not tweet this out. And I told both of them that, you know, it just seemed to me that this is a terrible accident. And I can only imagine something similar. You know, if you and I happen to be actors and somebody handed us a pistol, I'd like to think that I would have checked it out first. But
well, you know who doesn't know that it was a terrible accident? Nobody. Everybody knows it's a terrible
yeah.
accident.
Well,
so anyways, this is not about who did it. It's not about the politics of the person involved. If we want to talk about the substance of the thing that happened, I do confess to being a little bit confused out of my own naivete as to why in the world there is ever a loaded gun being used as a
you
prop
and me
in
both.
A movie.
Yeah.
And I'm sure someone out there has some answer about how dumb I am, because don't you know you have to have a real gun to really shoot? No, I guess I am dumb because
yeah.
I don't believe that.
No, I'm with you. My brother works in Hollywood and has told me that you know, for years now they've actually been able to, in post production, just add, you know, FX, you know, kind of stuff. Fake smoke, of course, the blow up sound of a gun popping. I do not understand why that happened. I do understand why a state lawmaker in California, that would be Dave Cortese of San Jose, Democrat and chair of the Senate Labor Committee, said he's going to introduce legislation that will ban live ammunition and firearms capable of shooting live ammo from California sets and theatrical productions. Dave, this took place in New Mexico. And, you know, maybe this is a great way to clean this up, but this reminds me of, is it Plato in the Republic who says that writing law is like cutting off the heads of a hydra?
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
you know, okay, so we're going to do that. We're going to ban this thing and then nothing bad will ever happen again. It just seems like common sense practice. And it seems to me that if you have to legislate common sense, then you have a real severe problem. But what do I know about writing the laws? It's important that California establish new safety standards. This is Mr. Cortese. And best practices for all those who work in the industry, and particularly in our own state. You know, again, his law would have changed nothing in New Mexico, I presume. But there it is. Listener Chris Morton, who I correspond with regularly, among about a dozen other folks out there who write to us every week with, you know, comments and suggestions for stories, has his own piece in the American Banker that just came out. And what I love about Chris's piece, he writes about a subject that you and I have talked about. That is Gavin Newsom signing off on a bill that is going to produce a study on the wisdom of creating a state-operated bank, mm-hmm. primarily for the quote-unquote underbanked.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris, you know, makes sort of many of the same arguments you and I have about, like, whoa, dude, seriously, you're going to trust to these state officials, the people who have run the DMV into the ground and made it a punchline, you're going to run who have, you know, the Employment Development Division's unemployment fiasco. We just heard from a hearing yesterday that the lower range of the fraud, which was $11 billion, the higher end range is about $31 billion. We're now at least $20 billion and counting in terms of fraud in the unemployment push that occurred in the last year during COVID relief. But Chris adds this other interesting thing, and I want to make it really clear. This is not his point. It's a thing that I picked up on in his story that I thought was really fascinating, David. He looks at the possibility that the funds from the state banking operation would be used specifically to invest in California projects. Now, he says it right here, likely pet projects that are politically advantageous. So I wanted to ask you about that. So you run your state bank, and then you've got this, supply of cash from depositors. And what do you think about the possible risks? Seems to me almost inevitable that the state's going to go, you know what, we're just going to invest this cash in a meaningful public enterprise, and we'll offer some, base market return. What do you think?
I think that there's only one way historically that you can avoid the appearance of impropriety, the potential for corruption, and yes, the actual corruption. And that is to not have the situation exist where such a thing can happen.
No state bank.
I mean, this is obviously ripe for corruption. And in this case, it's ripe for corruption. See, there's a lot of scenarios, like because of our view that there's no free lunch and trade-offs are necessary. There's a lot of scenarios where there bad things could happen, but they're necessary as a trade-off to what a desired outcome is, right? What's the ultimate trade-off right now in public discourse, even though it never gets worded this way?
Not sure.
Climate change.
Oh, of course. And
people being able to, live their lives.
Yeah.
So we say, global warming is a trade-off against the fact that we, travel and heat our houses and
have a
and,
car.
And so there's a trade-off there. And everyone that is of sane mind, sound mind, and honest mind says, well, let's figure out how we manage that trade-off in a way that is environmentally well stewarded and is not going to kill people or starve people. And so we lie to ourselves. Like, we pretend that we can get rid of it tomorrow and there won't be an impact. Or we pretend that there's no environmental consequence. We have to work through that stuff. There are things that you cannot have no corruption as long as you have government. And if you get rid of government, you'll still have corruption because it would be filled in by other corrupt, sinful people. And so you have markets that serve as governors. You have a law. You have the rule of law. You have a constitution. You have a frame of government that I think a framework like ours that has done a pretty good job to rein in the vices of man. And Will, the state bank is an example of, in California, there is no one even telling me what the other side of the trade-off is. There's opportunity for corruption. There's opportunity for bad things. What is the upside? What are we trying to get out of it that we cannot get? Are we unbanked in California?
No.
Is someone making the argument that there's an inability to get depository services in the state of California? There are way too many banks in California, okay? They need more Orange Theory Fitness and spin studios out of the bank real estate. They do not need as many banks. Because, first of all, no one even goes into a bank anymore. So I think what they ought to do is we're going to do a state initiative to get rid of banks, not to start our own bank. This was my argument when UCI announced that they were starting a law school. I said, I hope what you mean is you're starting a school to get rid of law schools. Because the last damn thing we need are 250 new lawyers graduating every year.
Yeah.
So I don't understand what I'm missing here about the upside of the state bank.
Well, Chris addresses this. He says the problem with this logic is that there are already banks that offer services targeting the underbanked. He says they're called neobanks. Have you heard of these neobanks? I have not. They have focused on making it easy to sign up for an account while also staying compliant with federal regulations. 10 years ago, that idea might have been a novel one, Chris writes, but it's outdated and presupposes that people who don't trust private banks will trust a government-run bank. Why would undocumented immigrants, he asks, really trust the state of California to store their money and not, for example, comply with a federal order to turn over the identity their identity information and potentially seize their assets? Great, great piece of writing in the show notes.
But in that case, is the reference to unbanked and underbanked people a reference to loaning money to people that have a hard time borrowing? Mm-hmm. Or is it a reference to people administratively have a hard time getting an account open because they don't trust depository institutions? Mm-hmm. See, if it's the first one, we already tried it once, subprime lending. There is a very simple solution for what should happen with people that are not good borrowers is they should not borrow money, and you should not lend them money. And if you say, okay, well, Bank of America won't lend them money, so instead the taxpayers are going to lend them money, we have a word for that too. It's called charity. But you only need market forces and price discovery to determine who should lend money. Because as long as lending is done at a profit, there will never be an inability to lend someone money if they're deemed to be a payer. So the question is not about lending. It's about deposits. So what does that mean? There's people who are uncomfortable using a bank. You're going to solve that with the state of California, to your point and his point. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. They're looking to scratch an itch that doesn't exist.
Your comment about there's always a trade-off. You and I, there's no free lunch. There's always a trade-off. Reminds me, I'm going to boost this up in our run list here, David, and talk about Kamala Harris. I wish we had intro music for this section. Maybe somebody can supply it for us, Brian.
Why didn't we ever do a musical thing every time we said Kamala's name? Have you noticed what Jonah does with Woodrow Wilson?
Yeah.
I don't understand why we didn't do something like that with Kamala.
Doesn't he do the theme from like Darth Vader's entrance, whatever it's called?
Is it Jaws or Darth Vader?
I think it's Darth Vader. I think it's Yeah, Woodrow Wilson. So here's the headline from Reuters. U.S. Vice President Harris to unveil steps to boost unions in federal workforce. Now, I want to talk later in the show about all the union news. There's so much of it, and I hope people will bear with me. It's not just my work. It's my passion, and you can probably understand why if you heard me talk about the Cato Institute's reform suggestions. But Harris is out there right now with U.S. Secretary of Labor Marty Walsh. If you don't know Marty Walsh, he is a former head of the Building Trades Council in Boston, former mayor of Boston. Not the most enlightened person unless you live in 1910 or 1890 or something like that, and then his ideas might seem really advanced. But she and Walsh are on a little tour announcing measures aimed at making it easier for unions to organize the country's more than 2 million workers. The idea here, David, and I love this, buried in the story, is it says that the percentage of U.S. workers represented by a union fell almost 15 percentage points between 1979 and 2020, according to the White House. That drop, the White House says, has cost workers $200 billion a year in unrealized wages and benefits. There's a trade-off in there. If you allow workers to organize, government workers in particular I want to talk about, you allow them to get into a union, we know what happens. Their membership dues flow into the union. The union leadership uses that money to elect candidates who, once in office, rubber stamp the pay increases and increased benefits of the public employees. That doesn't cost nothing. That's not nothing. So when they talk about a $200 billion a year and unrealized wages and benefits, what they neglect to tell us is that somebody is paying for that. Namely, in this instance of government unions, the taxpayer. Somebody pays for that. That money comes out of some other project that might be more meaningful to the public. But no, it goes directly to a government union. So why would Harris want this? Because she's from California. Because Marty Walsh is from Massachusetts. These are the states where government unions are so, so powerful, and they bankroll the Democratic Party. There's a story a little bit later I'll point out where the Service Employees International Union met in an emergency session. And where did they meet? In California, they met in Sacramento at the headquarters of the Democratic Party. Which opened up its doors and allowed the union to hold a big emergency meeting there. So these guys are just a wing of the Democratic Party. That's it. That's all they are. And they bankroll their candidates. And that's the goal here with Kamala Harris and Marty Walsh in trying to create steps to. And among the steps, I got to tell you, we already have these in California. The moves will include directing federal agencies to inform job applicants and new employees about unions during the hiring and onboarding process. How much do you want to bet that Kamala Harris is not going to include information that you do not have to join a union per the Janus Agreement? How about unions will also be allowed to participate in new employee training sessions? This is what we have in California. It's called mandatory union orientation. When you show up for your job in a state or local government, the union that covers your bargaining contract has first dibs on you.
To train you. Hey, you know that thing we were talking about a few weeks ago? I would like to mix two bad policies here.
Please.
So you have to mandatory training from a union when you show up at a job. And then we brought up a couple weeks ago the desire that they need to have some regulation around – what was the thing where – I can't remember the verb that was used. It was sort of disgusting about when people are not keeping their condom on.
Stealthing.
And we suggested that there be a government agency to regulate. What would that training, would that be mandatory training?
I'm sure they'd want a hand on that.
But when they show up for work, they have to get trained by a union person.
Well, it's not so much training. Let me be really, I hate to step on your line here. This is so good. Just to be really clear and in keeping with the premise of this very serious story, that it's not training. It is union orientation. It is where the union gets to bring you into a room, close the door, sit down with you and say, sign this. And if you have any objections, they basically boiler room you into signing a union agreement. There is no similar orientation opportunity for a group like mine, for instance, to come in and say, hey, here's the Supreme Court law. Here are all the reasons you might not
want to join. And the employers can't do anything about it.
The employers in California are bound, and these are government agencies, you know, school boards, the DMV,
so like before they learn like how to log in their computer, before they learn you know, various particular things to the nature of their work function. But now here's a good question, though. I mean, I'm actually kind of being serious. The unions do orientation before the HR people do diversity, equity, inclusion training?
That's a good question.
No, because if you think about it, what if someone is learning their rights as a union payer and what they the kind of
membership benefits,
collective bargaining benefits?
Yeah.
And then they make a racist joke.
Yeah.
Or they look at a female employee. Like, what if someone does some sexist or racist stuff? So I wonder, like, is there a way you could do both things at once?
I don't know. I think the HR thing is totally separate. I mean, this is literally you. I have talked to people who've been through this process, and they say they had no idea what they were signing. One lady, a woman who's a teacher up in the Central Valley, told me, "You ever signed one of those mortgage agreements when you buy your house? You know, all the papers you have to sign when you finally take ownership, and they hand you the keys. It's like that. Here's sign this thing, sign that thing, sign this thing. And if you raise any questions about union membership, oh yeah, everybody belongs." They say, or sometimes they say it's a condition of employment, which is specifically forbidden by federal law. Of course, it is your civil right not to join. So this is. I just wanted to point out that Kamala Harris learned how the machine works here in California, and now she's rolling it out inside the Biden White House. Meantime, I just wanted to point out something, and I think, you know, there's an interesting thing here. Kamala Harris is also really on the campaign warpath for Terry McAuliffe to return to the governor's mansion in Virginia. One of my favorite tweets that she issued here is, "So much is at stake in Virginia." This is just from a couple of days ago, I think. "So much is at stake here in Virginia, including the constitutional right to access abortion. As governor, Terry McAuliffe will fight to defend that right." Abortion, right? Same period of time, she's got a video that is being pushed out to black churches in Virginia. In which she
is 300 of them.
Yes, in which she is encouraging congregants of, I think, mostly Christian churches to back Terry McAuliffe, the guy she says is going to, make sure that everybody has immediate access to abortion. That wasn't even the most curious aspect of this that I really wanted to talk to. I think it is a curious aspect, a contradiction as I see it. I hope that Christians in Virginia and other people who are atheists and whatever who hate abortion, or at least just think that abortion is something that, you know, ought not to be trifled with. Like, this is a kind of a serious thing here. We really want to take a hard look at a guy who's just going to come in and guarantee your right to defend this thing. But in any case, and we could go on all day. But anyway, one of the things that happened immediately was that people raised 501c3 objections. That is, that churches, like other charities, like California Policy Center, are forbidden from participating actively in candidate elections. This video would seem to cross that line. Now, what I want to ask you, David, is on principle, because I think you and I might share a nuanced perspective here. On principle, do you think that the ban on charities, like churches, because they're covered by IRS regulation 501c3, which bans them from candidate elections, from speaking out on campaign elections, candidate elections. Do you think that's a legitimate ban?
No.
Do you think? Please talk to me.
No, I mean, I think that the issue is equal protection under the law, and I think that a church that is stating a political opinion, maybe the church ought not be doing it theologically. That we could discuss that separately, because it is a separate subject.
Sure.
I have opinions on that too. But in Dave Land, I would be fine with a leftist, woke, you know, whatever church, getting all pumped up on a candidate they like, and I'd be comfortable with the kind of Jerry Falwell side of things too. The way things work now, though, you're not supposed to do it when it's explicitly what all the law does now is force everyone into gamesmanship.
Right, exactly.
It forces them to say, I'm not picking a candidate, but we are strongly on the side of life. And you go, oh, well, pastor, this candidate's opposed to what you just said, and this candidate's for it. So do you like this other candidate? Well, I would never say. Yeah. I would never answer that. So we're supposed to, like, all play dumb.
Right.
So, if you're listening, get a pen. Write this down. Will and I are opposed to things that make people act dumb. Because it is. And it's insulting. Yeah. And I said this to you a few weeks ago about my view on the debt ceiling. It's a game. It's right. A charade. You don't need to have a debt ceiling. Just pass spending laws that don't exceed a certain debt level that you're uncomfortable with. What we do is we say we're gonna have a debt ceiling, and then we're gonna spend everything in perpetuity, and then we're gonna try to sit around and go, whoa, we got a debt ceiling. Why do you have a debt problem? You passed the law that spent more than the debt level right. would. So it's gamesmanship, right? So all that to say, I do believe that there is room for a church to go carry out an opinion, and I would be for it if it were consistent. The concern, of course, would be that in the present system, it would be allowed on one side, not the other.
Yeah.
But no, in Dave land, where there would be a classically liberal orientation to these things, it would be administered equally. So my problem with Kamala is not that I really have a problem with these churches, but if these churches want to back Terry McAuliffe, I do think they have a right to say so, civically and politically.
Mm-hmm.
Now, theologically, do I think a church should be using the pulpit to endorse a candidate? Well, again, even there, I would suggest that church probably ought to be focused on the weightier matters of the law. They ought to be focused on discipleship. They ought to be focused on the full presentation of their church's creeds and confessions and theological convictions, nurturing to the spiritual lives of their constituents. But to the extent any particular issue comes up, as a general rule, I think it would almost always be unwise to endorse a candidate. As a church, every now and then, like if you're Dietrich Bonhoeffer and you have an underground church and there's a Lutheran minister who wants to come in and help save Germany, and then there's Hitler, yeah, I'm not going to worry about separation of state in that case, and nor would anyone else.
Yeah.
So they're all full of it. This whole thing is nonsense.
Well, and of course, all of this traces back in legislative history and regulatory drafting to the government's deep desire to keep money out of politics, which is particularly a lefty initiative. You'll notice that though you and I talk all the time about how much money government unions raise and spend on politics, you and I have never, ever called for a ban on, a limit on how much unions can spend on politics. We've never said that. You and I regard cash as an extension of speech. And so we're consistent. Like, if there's money on the left, there's money on the right, and, we can tell people about why that's dangerous, but we have not proposed legislation. On the left, it's like McCain-Feingold, right? It's all these attempts, cutting off the heads of the Hydra, to say we're not going to allow money to influence politics because money is bad. And so then the IRS sets up this little safe harbor for charities and says, okay, you can go out and educate the public as a kind of a social welfare organization, but you can't spend money on a candidate. And so you're right. Most charities out there that, give a darn, have some sort of role in politics informally. But all of this phony free speech ban on 501c3s, phony because it extends back into this attempt to manage money and what has to be declared publicly under campaign finance laws and what doesn't. We're not required as a 501c3, just like any church, we're not required to identify our donors. If you're a political campaign, however, you have to identify your donors. Your donors' names have to show up on campaign filing forms. So that's what this traces back to, a failed effort on the part of the left to keep money out of politics. And so you get a church that's not allowed to speak the truth. And you have Kamala Harris saying, well, I believe that money is dangerous in politics when it comes from the right. And I believe that charity shouldn't be allowed to violate the 501c3 status if it comes from the right. And then she sends out a video to churches and encourages them to vote for a guy who will make sure that they double down on abortion. Okay. So,
well, and the other thing, too, that creates a big problem for the church is its own theological ignorance right now has also led to this thing where we accept a paradigm that the left wing elements of evangelicalism, and by the way, it's true in Rome as well, the left wing elements say, well, the church can preach on social justice and economic redistribution because that's a Christian principle. And then the right says, well, we can preach on marriage, fidelity, sexual ethics, and life because those are Christian principles. And I say, well, you know what? I don't think that the church has gotten these issues all right. Now, I think the church is largely correct when it's holding the traditional view of life and marriage. But there's your church has a difference of opinion on the death penalty that evangelical church. So that's a room for disagreement, right? But then the other part is the economic ethics, where people and this is largely true. Like in heavily labor, there's a lot of Roman Catholic elements in industrial Rust Belt, yeah. and the belief was, well, the biblical view or the Christian view is pro union, it's pro redistribution. And economic ethics, I don't trust the church right now to get the protection of private property right. I most certainly don't trust the church to preach against covetousness. I do trust the church to preach for covetousness. They have that down.
Yeah.
And by the way, I do trust the church to point out the wonderful miracle and beautiful glory of making good money right in time for their new building fund campaign.
Sure.
But I guess what I'm saying is a complaint on two sides of this. Mm-hmm. The politics of it are messed up, the judicial interpretation, what the expectation is civically, and then I think the church has got a lot to fix in its own backyard.
It has been ever thus. We talked last week and perhaps even the week before. I wrote a piece that appeared over the weekend at Fox News. I'll put that in the show notes, in which I just really talked about the fact, and David, you'll appreciate this especially, but listeners have probably already, you may recall with a shudder of PTSD that I have talked about, the origins of the Garland memo really do appear in the progressive era, and you can track it back to California in the 1860s when John Sweat, our fourth superintendent of public instruction, a Republican and a progressive. There was a time, yes, America, when all right-thinking Americans were progressives and really looked eastward toward, and I mean way east toward Germany, for their clues on how to organize a government, and specifically to the Prussian model. And John Sweat was one of these classically trained kinds of guys who really did believe in big government, in a government as the apotheosis of God's will for us, and therefore looked at the family as problematic to the free and full functioning of the school system. And so he absolutely objected to the idea. I lay this out in the whole story. He objected to the idea that parents should have any role in their children's education. And Garland, of course, comes out quite recently, October 4th, I believe it was, with a memo directing the FBI to investigate instances of parental blowback in school districts over things like COVID masking, social distancing, school closures, critical race theory, gender fluidity stuff. And so you've seen across the country, parents just fill up school district meetings and tell their electeds what they think of them. And Garland tried to make this into some major, just absolutely, he called it, you know, he didn't call it a domestic terrorism movement, but that was the underlying theme. And he got that phrase was in the document he pointed to. He pointed to a document that comes from the National School Board Association and says, help, we're being threatened by a wave of domestic terror. And this National School Board Association, closely tied to the National Education Association and the American Federation of Teachers, both teachers' unions, do not want the public, parents especially, to be involved in the education of their kids. Parents are messy. Democracy is messy. They want the unitary action of the school district officials to be able to just carry out whatever whim they are trying to exercise. So Garland writes his memo directing the FBI to investigate all these terrorist, quote-unquote, terrorist events. And within 2 weeks, on October the 18th, I believe it was, the National School Board Association says, whoops, our bad. We did not mean to refer to parents as domestic terrorists. We regret the inference. They pulled the letter back. Well, Garland, just before you and I get on here to record with Brian right over there.
Did they say we shouldn't have referred them as domestic terrorists, or we didn't mean to?
That's a great and subtle distinction. They said, we did not mean to say that we regret any harm. We certainly don't believe that that's what's going on here. And yet Garland gets on the, in front of, I believe it's the Senate Judiciary just this morning. Where was he? Senate Judiciary Committee. He's speaking to them. And Dick Durbin says, hey, you do know that the National School Board Association has pulled back its letter, which was the basis of your statement that, in fact, parents were a real rising threat and part of perhaps an anti-democratic movement. And he said, well, you know, I think all of us have seen these reports of violence and threats of violence. That's what the Justice Department is concerned about, Garland says in the committee this morning. He says there's a rising tide of violence. That's the reason we responded as quickly as we did when we got a letter, indicating that there was violence and threats of violence with respect to school officials and school staff. It does not change the association's concern about violence and threats of violence, he said, the fact that the NSBA pulled this out. Now, I could go on about this for a long, long time. But I do want to point out two things that are really critical. Number one, the Civil Rights Commission has come out. Four of its eight members came out and told Garland, you need to rescind this deployment of the FBI immediately. Like, this is just bogus. There is no rising threat of domestic terror. You're a knucklehead.
So who is giving that instruction?
These are the four conservative members of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights.
Okay.
Telling Garland, you're wrong. There's no problem here with these parents. We don't see any evidence. They end their letter with a pretty direct thing. We now ask you to provide us with specific examples of harassment, quote, harassment, intimidation, and threats of violence that you purport allow for federal law enforcement action and an explanation of why this is a situation that calls for federal intervention in particular. So I want to ask anybody who's listening out there who can, go to a school board meeting. Raise your hand, fill out the little card that allows you your 3 minutes of time to speak directly to your school board, and tell them to abandon their membership in the National School Boards Association. Tell them to tell Merrick Garland you're not a domestic terrorist. And then tell them that there's still, even though the NSBA, the National School Boards Association, has pulled their letter out, David, there's still a California School Board Association far to the left of the national organization that has written a letter to Gavin Newsom that makes roughly the same claims. I mean, it is a almost mirror image of that same letter to the federal government. You know, they complain in the California letter that they tried to get law enforcement to bust up these parents who are showing up at school board meetings all throughout California, and that local law enforcement is refusing to act, indicating a kind of collusion, they suggest, between the quote-unquote terrorists and law enforcement. Where have you heard that one before? It's like, yeah, really kind of looking at like a January 6th insurrection thing. So this is a letter from a guy who styles himself Vernon M. Billy. He is the CEO and executive director of the California School Boards Association. His letter asks Newsom to make sure that the attorney general of the state of California, Rob Bonta, convinces, commands, and otherwise urges local law enforcement to uphold public health and safety orders, help maintain order at local school board meetings when requested, and enforce the laws they are sworn to do. Well, they are enforcing the law. I've actually spoken at school board meetings in the last 6 months, well, actually the last 18 months, and there are armed officers in those meetings frequently. And in every meeting I went to, they were there to protect people like me who were testifying from the yahoos on the outside who are basically motivated by people like Antifa and the teachers unions and Black Lives Matter. They were not there to stop people like me from speaking. They were upholding the law. Anyway, David, thoughts on school board antagonisms?
Yeah, I remain of the same opinion I've been all along, and I echo everything you just said. That I don't believe that this is a real issue. I think it is a playbook that we're familiar with from them. I think Merrick Garland is beclowning himself in the way he's handling it. And I do believe that parents have, in many cases, not merely the right, but the duty to go get pretty fired up on what's going on. To the extent that people say, well, are you worried that they could translate that into some kind of abuse or excess? The answer is no. I don't think it happens very often. I think it has happened in one, two, or three isolated cases in the entire country of 330 million people. And I also think that it's not very hard to say that you're for something and against an excess. And it's not too hard to say you're against something but for an exception. Like, there are nuances here mm-hmm. that don't seem very complicated to me.
No.
But this is narrative formation. This is gamesmanship.
I love that. Narrative formation. Did you just make that up?
I just, those words have been in the dictionary for a long time.
Well, I know that each of them has, but
and I used them together.
You used them together. I really like that phrase.
Thank you. Are you writing that down?
I just did.
Let me sign that.
Would you please? Hey, there is like, as my late great father-in-law, a man who was raised on a farm, used to say, Bill William, you're trying to put 10 pounds of, he said a different word, but you're trying to put 10 pounds mm-hmm. of feces into a 5-pound bag. So I've got like an extra hour of show notes here that we could go through. Can I just make a couple of quick observations? The governor
and by the way, well, we have a little more time because I told you before about a certain cutoff time and that has been extended. So let's do what you got to do.
Okay, thank you, brother. Okay, so I want to talk about a couple of union things here real fast. We have told you, David and I, about this this presidential candidate who ran for an internal election to the post of president of the Service Employees International Union, the largest union in California. They cover all kinds of things, psychiatric nurses in state prisons. Your local DMV worker is likely an SEIU member, as are lots of other folks. And SEIU's presidential candidate, Richard Brown, was running through May on a campaign to end political funding, any kind of political funding from SEIU to any candidate, whatever, to cut membership dues in half and to reform the union inside, which he declared absolutely corrupt. Brown won. And he won in part because members were starting to look around. The union has been hemorrhaging members in part because of an effort led by California Policy Center to help government workers get out of these terrible unions. But Brown wins because that union really is hemorrhaging cash. They need new members. They don't have much money left. They are struggling financially. So Brown wins in an upset, and the establishment, the empire, strikes back. They hold this meeting just a couple of days ago over at the Democratic headquarters in Sacramento, the California Democratic Party headquarters. And their members decide they're going to strip him of all of his powers. Now, talk about a coup, right? I mean, these are very likely the people who would, under ordinary circumstances, see a coup and identify it as a coup. But here they have gone, and they have taken their members' votes, thrown them into the garbage, and said, nope, nope, we're actually going to make sure that this union continues under our auspices. So they strip Brown of his authority. They try to impose themselves as the new leaders of the SEIU. Brown says, this is illegal. It doesn't even matter. Like, forget it. But meantime, a leader of SEIU has resigned. She and her husband are apparently now they've been charged by no less than Rob Bonta, the attorney general's office. Alma Hernandez and her husband, Jose Marasco, on October 4th, were charged with using his private business to basically pay their own people under the table. They were paying employees of her husband's business under the table to avoid all kinds of things like payroll taxes and health benefits and wage and hour rates, that sort of thing. Precisely the sorts of things that SEIU backed when it appeared in Lorena Gonzalez's Assembly Bill 5. If you go down the list of everything that Lorena Gonzalez and Alma Hernandez have said, capitalism is evil for having produced these terrible features in the free market and the gig economy, whatever. AB 5 was supposed to protect all of us. Alma Hernandez's husband is running a business and she's working it with him, apparently, according to the charges. And they are denying their own employees the same benefits that they are protesting only a union can provide people and only the state can provide people. Worse than that, she's also the director of one of the political action committees for SEIU and reportedly sent $10,000 of SEIU political action committee money to her husband for services not rendered. So while the union is attacking their own guy, Richard Brown, who was elected by the members to reform this corrupt union, one of their people is charged by Rob Bonta. And I think there's an interesting question here. I was asked by a number of reporters, like, you know, why is Rob Bonta going after this person? And the answer is that Rob Bonta, our attorney general, who is so close to these very government unions, they back his campaign, is in a hard spot. This investigation has been going on for 2 years. If he tries to step on this thing, he's going to have, I think, a bigger mess. But, David, I could go on. I'll put a bunch of stories in the show notes. You know, the bottom line here is that these are not nice people who are trying to fight this guy, Richard Brown. And you don't have to love Richard Brown or SEIU in order to say that the people he's fighting against are pretty savage and nasty, brutal people who have revealed themselves here in this meeting.
I completely agree with you. The enemy of your enemy is your friend. I mean, this is nasty stuff.
Yeah. Hey, and, you know, Gavin Newsom believes that everybody, there should be vaccine mandates all over the place. I want to point out that one.
Yeah, we got to talk about this.
You want to?
What are you going to say?
I was just going to say, here's the headline. Gavin Newsom, this is from San Francisco Gate, which is the Chronicle's, I believe the Chronicle's website, if I'm not mistaken here. Here's the headline. Gavin Newsom, who said Democrats should, quote, lean into vaccine mandates, asks the court to halt one. Is that the story you were thinking of?
No.
Okay, let me just run through it real quickly because this is fascinating. Everybody who is a government worker in California is now, according to Gavin Newsom, supposed to get vaccinated, right? That's just the thing. It's essential for everybody's health, the government mandate a vaccine. You and I, David, we love the vaccine. We've talked about it endlessly. We're both opposed to mandates. We think that mandates are a bad thing in this instance and certainly in a lot of others. But here, Gavin Newsom actually has gone to federal court to block the mandate for one particular group of California public employees, the Prison Guards Union, who gave him almost $2 million in his recent bid to beat back the recall. This definitely looks like a quid pro quo to me. I find this really just so ruthlessly obvious. I mean, this is a governor who seems to have quid pro quo as kind of his family crest motto, I think.
All right, so let's on a higher level. Apart from that exception and the whole, you know, Newsom stuff, just at a high level, now that the FDA has approved the vaccine for children ages 5 through 11, and you and I are in favor of vaccines at large, and I confess that it's very hard for me to get that animated about vaccines for kids when their mortality rate is 0%.
Right.
My question is not what we think is right or wrong, because you and I are against mandates for 50-year-olds, let alone for 5-year-olds in the case of the COVID vaccine. Do you believe that they are going to mandate child vaccines?
Yes.
Do you believe that the people will put up with that in the state of California?
No. I believe that a significant minority of people will push back.
I have a very hard time believing that they can get away with that. I think that we are talking about something that at this point is in the rearview mirror for most people. It's in the rearview mirror of their hearts and increasingly their minds. Like, in other words, they want it to be over, and then in most ways they believe it and think it to be over. Mm-hmm. They're mostly right about that in terms of the data. But then now, you know, when you look, I don't believe in the vaccine mandates for 50-year-olds. I don't believe in the vaccine mandates for 50-year-olds. I don't believe in the vaccine mandate for 50-year-olds. However, I at least understand the logic for why we want a more vaccinated society from the vantage point of immunity. Mm-hmm. I also believe that what I just said includes the ability to replace the vaccine with natural immunity for those who previously had COVID and have antibodies. But whether or not that exists, I still don't believe in vaccine mandates for anybody. Has everyone got that?
Here's
my question. How are they going to convince people emotively when the data on the 50-year-olds they were able to convince about 78%? That took a lot of work. They still can't get certain high-profile NBA players and this and that. Like, you know, that 20% they're not getting vaxxed. They've gone as far as they can. Don't you think?
Yeah.
I don't think the vax skeptic adults are movable at this point.
I think you're right. In fact, there's lots of evidence to support that.
I think the number was getting better before he started threatening people with a press release of a mandate. Mm-hmm. Okay. But that was with 50-year-olds who had a certain mortality rate and with 70-year-olds who had a higher mortality rate. The 5 to 11-year-olds, I know how people are about their kids.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe this is doable. Even in a state of largely a bunch of sheep like California, I don't think they can get away with this. But you think they can?
No, I think that they can't. I think that they will impose a mandate, and I think there will be such tremendous blowback. You and I discussed this. I thought that Merrick Garland made a fatal error in labeling parents or helping to label parents domestic terrorists when they oppose things like vaccine mandates and masking in schools and social distancing in schools, critical race theory. The way that you make that stuff explode is you make it illegal to say that you oppose this. So here again, I think that the way you make parents' heads explode, including mine, and my kids are all grown, so I don't really have a puppy in the fight, if you will. But I'm opposed to making parents vaccinate their kids if you go on the California State Department of Public Health right now and look at COVID deaths by age, you will find almost, I think it's exactly 0.0% of deaths are in children under the age of 18. There have been a handful of deaths. In that same time, I'll bet you there have been a handful of pool drownings and automobile accidents involving kids and flu and pneumonia and other stuff that's just terrible and tragic to even contemplate when it involves a child. But 0.0% is a pretty persuasive number. That's the level at which Saddam Hussein wins elections, the opposite direction, rather.
And then they put themselves in that position. I've never understood why it hasn't been more embarrassing for them. What they will say is, yeah, Johnny's not going to die, but we need Johnny to get mandatory vax because Johnny can bring it home to Grandma and Grandpa.
Right.
And you say, but Grandma and Grandpa already vaxed.
Right.
And so they are in this circular thing they can't really get out of, other than them either undermining the credibility of the vaccine, which is both scientifically and politically inaccurate, or they are just, I think, testing the raw exercise of political power. Mm-hmm. It's very problematic. So state by state will adjudicate this. The feds won't do a mandatory 5 to 11. My guess is that this thing could be a straw that breaks the camel's back. But I just, and again, I'm dumb. I don't know anything. I just think that some of the people involved are smart enough to know where the ceiling is here.
And we're, just to be clear, you're speaking about people in California.
I'm saying the political powers.
Okay.
When people go, oh, well, that didn't stop them from trying to shut the beaches down, that doesn't defeat my argument, because my argument was not that he wouldn't be experimental. My argument was that he would be experimental and he would do exactly what he did, which is way overreach. Find out whether there was pushback and then recalibrate around it. And I suspect that maybe that's where this goes. But I would think, even putting it out there, there are so many people that are not us politically that would just be like, hell to the no.
Hell no.
It ain't going to happen.
Yeah. Okay, last union story, I promise. But I this is just such a fun one for me. I was digging through some notes here and I found online, Assembly Bill number 237, signed by the governor on October 9th. I missed it then, but I saw it over the weekend. This bill, it says in paragraph 2 of AB 237, this bill would enact the Public Employee Health Protection Act, get this, which would make it an unfair practice for a covered employer, that is a government agency, to fail or refuse to maintain or pay for continued health care or other medical coverage for an enrolled employee, that's a government employee, or for their enrolled dependents, for the duration of the enrolled employee's participation in an authorized strike at the level and under the conditions that coverage would have been provided if the employee had continued to work in their position for the duration of the strike. Here again, you ask, which side is he on, the governor? Is he on the side of people who might actually need a government service, and yet when they go down to City Hall or the DMV or whatever, they find there's nobody there and they're on strike and they absolutely need an essential government service, but the workers are on strike? The governor has said, hey, they don't have to work, but you have to pay them. It doesn't matter. They have to continue to be paid, and now they have to continue to have their benefits paid for health insurance. This is a sort of thing that I think should make people quite anxious. It makes me very upset to see the government put its thumb on the scale and say,
amen.
Yeah, go on strike. We'll subsidize it.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to just run through one last thing real quick, and that's just, I'm just going to put a bunch of stories in the show notes, David. You and I have talked about San Francisco at such great length that I feel like we could have a separate edition of Radio Free California just dedicated to the bizarreness of San Francisco, but sometimes that just feels like, you know, picking on the handicapped kids. So let me just run down the list here. Great stories. San Francisco has become a shoplifter's paradise, Wall Street Journal. Iconic Target store on Mission Street to close amid shoplifting tidal wave. California families now hire private security as a crime tsunami overwhelms local police. Our friend Chris Morton sent that one in too, that people hiring private security will, as he said, cue the claims of racism. And privilege. Bay Area's In-N-Out fanboys should have ended long before the vaccine news. This is a piece in the, I think it was a Chronicle, in which a young millennial says, oh, the In-N-Out burger is terrible because it's religious and their food is not good for you. You should become a vegan. Two San Francisco prosecutors have quit and joined the effort to recall their boss, District Attorney Chase Boudin. I always have to think about that one. And then a great piece by Robert Kaufman, The Mob That Canceled Junipero Serra Will Soon Devour Everyone. I'm thinking about that because San Francisco is all about renaming people. David, I could go on, but I'll just put all those in the show notes and ask people to enjoy themselves. I think there's a lot of fun stories in there, man.
You know, I think that you prepared for this podcast today as well as you ever have. I'm very impressed.
Oh, thank you, brother. Sure. I tried to make it, you know, easy on the ears. Thank you, man. All right. Well, that's all the time we have today. You can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but it's easier for you, I swear, and better for us if you subscribe. And of course, rate and review the show wherever you subscribe. That boosts our profile and others, helps others find us. And don't forget David's offer. Send us proof. You'll find our email addresses in the show notes. Send us proof that you have purchased this book already from some... Does it have to be on Amazon? Because we've actually gotten people who said, no, not necessarily.
No, they can purchase it anywhere. But again, the issue is we want that review up. And I think to review on Amazon, don't you have to have purchased it from Amazon?
Yeah, I think you would.
I actually don't think you have to. I think it just marks it as a verified purchaser if you did.
Mm. Okay.
But either way, they'll have to figure that out.
So. We've clearly not thought this through entirely on the regulatory
side. No, we
have
thought through that. Details irrelevant. They can buy it from anywhere.
All right. Please email us. You'll find our email addresses, Twitter handles, and other fun details in the aforementioned show notes. On behalf of my friend and co-host David Bonson, we give thanks as ever to show producer Sarah Schutte, our recording engineers Brian Steely Dan Tong and Glenn, who is that? Pink Floyd Hall. And to all of our friends at National Review, thanks also to Metalachi, that's the LA-based mariachi and metal band, for our music. La revolución continúa en la semana próxima.